Good Friday afternoon. Welcome to the Buckmaster Show, broadcasting from the Green Thing Socolo Village Studio. It's August 30th, 2024. We're heading into a long and, I hope, restful Labor Day weekend. Bill's out taking a break. I'm Dan Scheer, editor of the Green Valley News and the Sahuarita Sun, sitting in for Bill. He's going to be back on Tuesday. On Friday, Bill gives a high five to the Buckmaster Show media partners. Those include TucsonSentinel.com, Green Valley News, Sahuarita Sun, Tucson Local Media, and there's a new one to the fold, Tucson Agenda. Check them out. They're very good. You'll find all of those and more on his website at buckmastershow.com. And remember that you can find all the archives of all of Bill's shows there, too. It's an unmatched treasure of Arizona history with extensive interviews, a lot of breaking news. It's great stuff. And speaking of history, our Friday Focus interview today is just about that, Southern Arizona history, and the direction we're going to go, I guarantee it will surprise you. It's very, very interesting. If you have a question or comment anytime during the show, you can call us at 520-790-2040. That's the Buckmaster Show live line, presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Now I want to welcome to the show two people. One has been on the show in the past, documentary filmmaker Francis Causey. Welcome, Francis.
Thanks. Great to be here again.
Great to see you again, and we'll talk about some of your work. Joining us is Dr. Denny Seymour, and if you are interested in history and archaeology, buckle up, because she is a research archaeologist, holds a PhD in anthropology from the University of Arizona, and has four decades of experience. Welcome, Dr. Seymour.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Francis, I have seen a lot of your work, and it always makes me think. I'm going to just go over a few of some of my favorites. The Long Shadow, it's about slavery and ties to racism today. Heist, Who Stole the American Dream, about the Great Recession just a few years back, which was just fascinating stuff. It touched everybody in this country. And one I haven't seen yet, but I intend to, called Final Fight, about the trauma of war. And last week, your latest documentary premiered on PBS. It is titled Coronado, The New Evidence, and it is about the work of Dr. Seymour. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, Denny, Dr. Seymour, approached me about almost 4 years ago, and Dan, and, you know, she said, I think I have Coronado and in Southern Arizona. And, you know, as a journalist and filmmaker, very rarely do you get approached with ideas that are completely as earth-shattering as the one that she was proposing. And so we started shooting about 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago, and we shot in secret, and it's just earth-shattering. I mean, the what she's discovered, it, there's so many firsts, which I'm sure we'll go into. So as a filmmaker and journalist, it was, you know, a dream come true.
So basically we have Francisco Vazquez de Coronado, Spanish explorer in the 1500s. He had been in South America, then Mexico, and then he decides to head up into the continental United States, what we know of it today, and to find treasure. He was ordered by the Spanish crown to go north, and everyone agrees on that. But Dr. Seymour, what did you find that was a little different than what we'd heard before?
Yeah, well, the everyone was expecting the route went through Arizona, southeast Arizona, and Arizona, and portions of Arizona in general, but everybody thought that the first sites would be found on the San Pedro. And it turns out they're 40 miles or so to the west. The first site we found was in the Santa Cruz River Valley rather than the San Pedro. We've since found a total of 12 sites in Arizona, and most of them are in the San Pedro River Valley to the northeast of where we're at, and one is along the Gila. But that was a surprise. We found, the first site we found was in the Santa Cruz River Valley where it wasn't supposed to be, and then also it turns out that it's a settlement rather than just a campsite.
And it was really more than just a surprise, because you've basically flushed a cherry bomb down the toilet of history, because everybody had their belief, and you're saying, maybe not.
Exactly. Those beliefs have been around for quite some time. I think, you know, some of the earliest modern historians came to some conclusions. And there were used to be a variety of opinions on the various routes. But some of the one of those in particular got solidified, and people have kind of adhered to that because the documents can be made to make sense that way. And there's been no archaeological evidence in this area.
And so as if we were to agree that this actually happened 40 miles west of where everybody else thinks it's happened, what's the significance of that?
Well, there's several things significant. First of all, it is much the settlement of Suya or San Jeronimo III is further north than everyone thought. Also, being in southern Arizona, in the Santa Cruz Valley, it changes at least a portion of the route trajectory. And most importantly, from my perspective, it involves the Otham, the modern-day descendants of the Sibaypri Otham and other Otham who Coronado encountered. And up to this point, most scholars have thought that it was the Opata who the Coronado expedition encountered. And the fact that it is the Otham means it totally changes Otham history, and the relevance of this to them is just enormous in the sense of the first successful Native American uprising in the continental U.S. There are earlier battles, but this one, they chased them out and they didn't come back.
For 150 years.
For 150 years, yeah.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but we believe that the first European settlement, and that's what we're taught, was Jamestown, Virginia, 60 years after this happened. And by the way, we're talking about 1540 to about 1542 for the expedition.
1539, actually, to 1542. And this particular settlement was established in 1541 and was probably destroyed by the end of 1541. Is kind of what I'm thinking, maybe early 1542, but probably 1541.
So what's it take to make it a settlement?
That's a really good question, because that is something that we as archaeologists delve into deeply. And I've spent my entire career studying permanent settlements or long-term settlements versus campsites and so on for mobile groups. And so I was primed for this study. And what makes it a settlement and what makes it more important than just an overnight encampment is that they intended to stay. The viceroy and the king had sent letters back and forth about if you establish settlements and when you establish settlements, you'll do this. And then this place was referred to a villa or town site by a half a dozen people on the expedition, including the viceroy and Coronado. And so what we expect, and this has been part of the research, why it's taken so long to do the research and to ultimately publish on it and to come public with it, is that we had to excavate to prove up that by finding permanent Spanish-style structures, stone and adobe structures that indicate more than an overnight encampment and a diversity of artifacts.
And when you say people refer to it as a settlement or a villa, we're talking about the letters that were written during the expedition to basically just catalog what was happening.
And also the accounts that were written afterwards. It's repeatedly referred to as a villa or town site. Yeah.
So, Francis, you are a trained journalist and a very good one. Someone comes to you and says, yeah, we think history is this way, but it really might be that way. Certainly you don't jump on board right away. What was your thought process when she came to you?
Well, after the initial, excitement, as you know, it's daunting to make these films. They take 3 to 4 years to conceive, shoot, edit, mm-hmm. get them out into the world. And so, and I also kind of have to get up to speed really quickly on the subject.
Yes.
And so I started, I started doing my own research, and Denny supplied me also with what she had. And I was very nervous about the fact that nothing like this had been discovered. There had been some other overnight encampments, I think in New Mexico, maybe one in Texas, Western Texas discovered. And so I didn't have, I didn't have a critical mass of information to come back with authority and say, well, what about this? What about that? But I got up to speed pretty quickly, and I fast learned that I could, because I don't ever trust my subjects right away, right? It takes me, takes me a while to get to that point. But Denny pretty quickly convinced me that she was her harshest critic, and that she was going to lead me down that path of saying, this is what it could be. This is what the naysayers are saying. And then I was very concerned that because there had not been a Coronado discovery of this magnitude, that I wouldn't have, the critical analysis I needed to feel good about making a movie about it. But in the end, she satisfied many of those roles, but also brought in people who were skeptics or people who still weren't sure. And, you know, she painstakingly invited her critics, if you'll call them that, you know, her critics to the site to assess what she discovered there.
Well, the evidence just builds on itself throughout the documentary. So you start out, as I did when I first heard the story that she was researching this a couple years ago. No way. That's your first thought. Because this is what we learned. It's like, you know, Columbus discovered America. Not really, folks. Anyway, and then you roll it out and you see it. Number one, you determine she's not trying to make a name for herself. She's trying to catalog history accurately. And then she does it. And you're right that she's her own worst critic comes out in the documentary because you want to get it right. But Dr. Seymour, there are other critics. What are they saying?
There are. You know, everything that I present, either professionally or to the public, there's always critics. Everybody thinks that they know. And, you know, that's part of my job is to educate the public and to bring them along. Like some of my videos on YouTube, it's like, no, this is not an ox shoe, it's a horseshoe, and kind of things mm-hmm. like that. But with regard to professionals, we're trained quite differently in many cases at different institutions. And also historians are trained differently than archaeologists, just as geographers are. And so they have a different knowledge base, a different methodological and theoretical base. And so you got to bring them along too, but they have to be willing. And so what I'm finding is everyone almost is on board except for a handful of people. And the handful is basically two couples that are have been researching this forever. And mm-hmm. I understand that they have views, but being unwilling to discuss it and see the evidence and argue about the actual evidence is where we're kind of at with just a couple of people, really. But most people have come on board when they actually see the evidence. I mean, it's so overwhelming. We
right.
have thousands of artifacts and definitive artifacts. I mean, it's just...
The expedition itself, and just to help people to remember this, could have involved up to 3,000 people, but they came in waves, is what your documentary says. And then we know that some have split off because some discovered the Grand Canyon, first Europeans to see that. And then you can see as you look at the trail that there were, you know, little expeditions heading off in certain direction. But it was waves of people. And you say in the documentary that no archaeologist has ever worked with historians to identify campsites.
For Anza, Anza expedition.
Correct. Why not? You would think that archaeology and history are kind of go hand in hand.
Well, they do, but many archaeologists don't study historical archaeology. It's a limited, a separate kind of part of archaeology. And I'm not really a historical archaeologist. I'm an archaeologist that happens to study that period that transitions from before Europeans and then after. And it just so happens that I've gone earlier and earlier in time as I find more evidence.
Okay.
Dan, let me interject one thing.
Sure.
What was fascinating was Denny's process in that and how she was connecting the dots. She wasn't just using the artifact, you know, the archaeological record and the artifacts, but she's so well-versed in the documents, but also her kind of, I call her spidey sense in terms of topographical knowledge of the area, where the water sources would be, and I'd very much like to make a documentary just on her process alone.
Oh, I bet. If you're just joining us, we are talking about a new documentary out, Coronado, The New Evidence. It was put together by Francis Causey, a documentary filmmaker, and it is examining the work of Dr. Denny Seymour on the route of the Coronado expedition in the 1500s. There have been Coronado sites identified in New Mexico and Texas. And again, the expedition ended in near Salina, Kansas. Is that, we think?
In Kansas somewhere, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was only a subset of it.
Okay.
So it went through Arizona and up to Zuni or Cibola, and then over to the Tiwish province, which is Albuquerque, Bernalillo. And then they went out on the plains, and then went up. Some of them came back, and they went up to Kansas, and then they came back to Albuquerque and spent another winter. And while there, they stayed for quite a long time, and they fought several battles. So you should have siege encampments, which we think one of them might be. They stayed in pueblos, but that was different. Those are quarters. Those were occupations. They weren't settlements. It's a different concept.
Very, very good. Okay, we are in the midst of our Friday Focus interview with Francis Causey and Dr. Denny Seymour. You are listening to the Buckmaster Show, broadcasting from the Green Thing Socolo Village studio. Our live line is made possible by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. And remember, if you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 520-790-2040. We'll be right back.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is finalizing a new 20-year plan for RTA board review and approval to seek public feedback on the draft plan. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Cushman & Wakefield Picor is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield Picor offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at picor.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's picor.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Quality of Life Medical Center has served Tucson residents for more than 20 years. We understand the key to a long, healthy life is not just about getting the right medical treatment, but it's also about feeling good mentally and emotionally. Whether you're looking for preventative care or treatment for a specific condition, we're here for you. And we are accepting new patients for primary care, pain management, and sexual health. Please visit QLMC.com to request an appointment. Quality of Life. Our name says it all.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary. Home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
And welcome back to the Buckmaster Show. I'm Dan Shearer, sitting in for Bill, who has started his Labor Day weekend just a little bit early. I'm with Francis Causey and Dr. Denny Seymour, and we're talking about history and challenging the status quo, which is what Francis's new documentary focuses on. It's called Coronado, The New Evidence. Francis, where can people see this?
They can see it if it's on PBS stations all across the country. Like most folks know, each station is its own network, so if it's not programmed right yet, go ahead and call your station and ask them to program it. We have a three-year deal with them. We're happy to say it aired in our home market last week on KUAT. And if you're a Passport, if you're if you subscribe to the paywall, behind the paywall, the Passport, PBS Passport, you can watch it there.
Very good. And that's how I watched it, as a matter of fact. So, Dr. Seymour, okay, so let's dig into the dirt. It wasn't like you stumbled over something in the last couple of years and said, my gosh, this could be related to Coronado. How long have you been actually studying this? And then let's talk about what you found to prove your thought.
Sure. So, you know, I think any archaeologist in Arizona who's out in the field a lot has the dream of finding Coronado because it's hard to find. And it was such a quote, glorious expedition is how the historians have kind of presented it through the years. And it's hard to find. So, it's kind of attractive for that reason. But I don't know, maybe 25 or so years ago, I actually went to a series of museums and sites and so on to familiarize myself with the actual artifacts, hold them and so on. We have to do that as archaeologists to really know them. And so I've spent quite a few years actually familiarizing myself because I figured if we're out in the field all the time and we're not finding it, there must be a reason. And it's largely because we weren't recognizing it. In fact, the artifacts that I ultimately found, other archaeologists had actually looked at and analyzed and didn't recognize their significance, the ones I found in the museum. So that reinforces the notion that you have to know what you're looking for, and that's why one of the reasons why we had not found it.
So it shows you go, the documentary shows you go walking into the museum and you're after these things that you had heard were there. You get them, but who had looked at them and kind of just didn't recognize what they had? I mean, are you talking historians, trained people, and why would they not?
So a couple of them were archaeologists. One was with the Park Service and one was with a private firm here that actually was part of Coronado site searches in the past. I don't know. I can't explain why they didn't recognize what they had, but the moment I saw them online, I knew exactly what they were. But they didn't know where they were in the museum, so it took a while to find them, which is why it took till July 6th, I think it was, to actually get out in the field, because I spent all of June trying to figure out where they were.
And we have, obviously the documentary takes us to the site. We're not disclosing where it is. I don't know where it is. It's in southern Arizona. Who owns the land? Are you at liberty to say that?
Not entirely, because, okay. But it has multiple owners, and it's under several jurisdictions. And all of the landowners are on board with what we're doing.
Okay, then let's talk about a couple of things that you actually found, a horseshoe and a nail. And I've never seen somebody so excited about finding a nail, but there's something special about this. And when you realize what it is, then you get excited too. Tell us about the horseshoe and the nail.
Sure. So the horseshoe and the nail were the first things I saw when I was working on trying to find Juan Bautista de Anza sites. And I ran across these and knew exactly what they were. It was a what some people call a carrot head nail, which we're now calling gable headed or faceted nails, bifaceted nails, and a medieval style horseshoe, which are very distinctive from much later horseshoes. And I'm doing a typology now, and they are in fact different from those in the 16 and 1700s. Mm. So they're very distinctive of Coronado. The nails were recognized widely as being highly diagnostic of Coronado, but the horseshoes were just maybe diagnostic. Now we know that they are definitively diagnostic of
Coronado. And then how many have you found as far as like the nails go?
Oh, I have 120 or 30 from this one site, and then I have a few more from other sites.
And then at one point, a lead ball was found. What was that?
It was lead shot.
And
we have quite a bit of that, basically a bullet from back then. And we have that from several sites. On the first site, Suya or San Jeronimo III, we actually have that battle from 1541. So we have not only lead shot all over the place from hunters, but also from the battle, which we have to sort. But we also have crossbow bolt heads. We have other kinds of arrow and atlatl heads. And so we have a whole range of materials. We have sword tips, we have daggers, we have...
What about the... Pretty interesting to me was the evidence of domestic, trying to set up a household, the
sure.
Ming pottery,
a lot of pottery. So that's the other reason that we know it's a settlement, because we have not only permanent features that they were in the process of building at the time, but we have Spanish ceramics under wall fall with, for example, a carrot head nail. So really excellent context for these things. So they nowhere else along the trail in these encampments have they actually found like green glaze, for example, and so on.
Go ahead.
But for the battle, we also found a cannon.
Right.
It's a bronze cannon. We since have found another one on the site. Both are adjacent to, the second one is in the battlefield and it blew up during the battle, which is really kind of cool. We're looking for the second piece now. We have a bunch of tools and lead that go with it scattered out from the cannon. So the evidence is clustered in various places, so it's really top-notch evidence.
And that was very moving part in the documentary, and when the wall gun or the cannon was found, and just to describe it to people, it's, I don't know, is it three feet?
42 inches long and about 40 pounds.
About 40 pounds. And so, Francis, you put a quote in there and it made me laugh, but it said so much. After the wall gun or the cannon is discovered, somebody with Dr. Seymour said, to hell with the helmets and stuff. This was big. I mean, and that's choosing that quote was so important and so good.
It's the oldest firearm ever found in the continental United States.
And on the continent, on the continental landmass. The other ones that have been found are in the water and their associations are questionable, so...
I know I'm going to get asked this question, so I'm going to just put it to you. Where will that thing eventually end up?
Everything I'm finding will be curated first at the Arizona State Museum, and then hopefully it'll be out on loan to various other local museums in Santa Cruz County and Pima and Cochise County. And then everybody's talking about the cannons going to Smithsonian, but we'd like to keep them local as much as possible.
You discover the cannon, then you unveil it to a historian and an anthropologist, and they determine that that it's a bronze artifact. I mean, getting that wrong. And what's the significance of that?
Well, so I've had the Historical Arms Society of Tucson and people all over this continent and in Europe provide input on its identification. So there's no question of its association and so on. But in the film, we had a portable X-ray fluorescence done on the surface of it. I didn't want to damage it. And they also tested the crossbow bolt heads and several of the other copper artifacts. And basically what they assessed is that it is, while it's a copper alloy, it is in fact bronze. The composition is consistent with bronze. But what they also determined from the cannon and the crossbow bolt heads is that they were actually made in Mexico, not brought from Spain.
Okay.
And they can tell by the composition of it. So we think it's crude as well. And it looks, there's a lot of reasons which we state in a paper that's been under review for so long, all the reasons why we think it was made in Mexico. And the cannons that we know about now were all made in the same foundry as well.
And we've referred a couple of times to how this this expedition was cataloged, and Coronado wrote, or people with him wrote, quite a few letters, and those are important letters, but they're one-sided, which we're going to get into a little bit about how the natives were treated at that point. But you've pulled quite a bit from those letters. Are they valuable? What's the value to what you're... do they support what you're finding?
Yeah, so there's letters, and then there's also reports that were done later, after the fact, which are the most detailed ones. So I use them all together, and all of these have been translated before, but I find that I have to retranslate them, given what I'm finding, because there's often multiple interpretations and of specific words or of the passages themselves. So I retranslate, and then there's a series of experts who do this for a living that I send it to and say, is this a reasonable interpretation and what else could it mean and so on. So I'm trying to be careful that way too. But when you have the archaeology, you have the geography, you have the ethnography, and then you have the later history as well, and then you have the documents, you can interpret them in new ways.
But you said that there were a couple of scholars in the past who had suggested that Santa Cruz was the route, but that didn't go anywhere. How come?
Well, early in time, there were a couple of them that did suggest the Santa Cruz River route. But our route does not go down the Santa Cruz, north down the Santa Cruz. It actually goes to the Santa Cruz and then it cuts over. And so they were kind of wrong too, in the sense that at least they had it on the Santa Cruz, but it doesn't go down the Santa Cruz. And the reason it doesn't is because the water is on the surface and then it goes underground. And at a certain point, like around Tubac, it goes underground for about 30 miles. Why would you follow the river north when it actually goes northwest and you want to go northeast? So they went cross country and hit really good water holes along the way.
Very good. Okay, we are with Frances Causey. She's a filmmaker, and Dr. Denny Seymour. She is an archaeologist and a lot more. There's a lot to talk about after the break, including the Native peoples, what it means to them today, what happened to those nearly 500 years ago, and the significance of all that. We will be right back on the Buckmaster Show.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
Are you ready to immerse yourself in a diverse culture while wandering through bustling markets, sampling exotic cuisines, or forging connections with people from all walks of life? Well, Bon Voyage Travel is here to plan your perfect journey. Whether you're setting off on a solo expedition, embarking on a group adventure, or simply dreaming of far-off destinations, we can help create your custom experience. The road ahead is filled with endless possibilities. Visit bvtravel.com to find your specialized Bon Voyage Travel advisor today.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The News and Sun's media reach 75% of the region through newspapers, websites, social media, video, newsletters, and more. They also produce more than a dozen print and digital magazines annually for an audience of 70,000. Find them at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, covering your hometown.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show, broadcasting from the Green Thing Socolo Village Studio. I'm Dan Shear, sitting in for Bill. We are with Frances Causey and Dr. Denny Seymour, and we were talking about a new documentary out there called Coronado, The New Evidence. And Dr. Seymour, Coronado's expedition, which lasted through 3 or 4 years, to what was he looking for? And the fact is, let's call it now, it was a failure.
Yeah, so in the past, everybody thought, oh, I'm looking for gold. And there are some scholars who say, no, they weren't looking for gold. Yeah, they were. In fact, Suya is one of the best gold areas in Santa Cruz County, and the documents say that they were mining gold before the uprising. But really what they were looking for also was a route to Asia so they'd have new markets. And they thought that it was connected. Oh. That's the way maps were at the time. Okay. I mean, that's how they understood the world at the time. And then also they were looking for labor. They wanted populations that were large enough, like in central Mexico, that they could get tribute and labor from them and then make a profit that way.
the natives were not always treated well. How's that for an understatement? What happened to a lot of them? How do we know that's what happened to them? And what eventually happened? Basically, they rose up.
Yeah, so all of the brutality that you hear about, I thought it happened mostly in the South. I mean, you hear about horrible things that happened in Albuquerque too, but we see in the documents, including those from the trial that occurred afterwards, that they were sleeping, the captain was sleeping with the wives and daughters, in other words, raping them.
Mm-hmm.
They were cutting off the noses, tongues, and hands of the Sibipriotum, and also taking two-thirds of the resources, which would be deadly. And so basically they warned them. In fact, we know from later documents that they actually, amazingly, they made some prickly pear wine, got drunk, and put up a effigy and started shooting arrows at it and yelled, "Captain, Captain," and warned them, basically. And the captain didn't pay attention. And so we don't know how much time was in between, but they attacked at dawn. And it looks like people from, meaning Otham, from all over the land came to assist. And no Sibipri were killed, but most of the settlement's occupants were. There's a variation in the number of people that got killed according to the documents, and I figured out, I think, what's going on. They only really mention, for the most part, the deaths of the Spaniards. So there are four Spaniards who died, including the captain, and then the rest of the 100 people that were killed were slaves and domestic servants and probably Indios Amigos, the warriors that came from the South to assist. So, and only usually the men are mentioned. So every time they talk about numbers of people, they're talking about Spanish men. So,
and then when we get back to, we'll get back to the Native Americans and everything, but let's finish up Coronado's story. He eventually is back in Mexico. He goes on trial for this. And what happens?
Well, he gets off because he was well-connected.
Yeah.
And the only person that was convicted, basically, was also a person that was fell off, but he was a slightly lower status. And ultimately, his sentence or whatever was so minimal that it didn't match the crime. And it's kind of like what happens today. If you're well-connected, you get consideration.
Maybe it's a foolish question, but were there any Native Americans at the trial? Probably not. Francis, the theme of a lot of your work is injustice and how this, and here we have another example of it. Was it just the way it is?
Well, it was to a certain degree, but you have to remember, and this is usually what comes up in most of my films, is the injustice was engineered. Right. Mm-hmm. It was on purpose. It was just the way it was. But there were certainly people, like there were abolitionists, you know, who rose up and to start the anti-slavery movement. So there were people who, you know, were opposed to what was happening. But, you know, the power and money prevail, I guess, in many cases.
Dr. Seymour, so this was the first successful Native American rebellion in the continental United States. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that challenges what we had previously thought had happened in this area.
Yeah. And so there were earlier battles, and, you know, there were a couple of earlier settlements in the Southeast, but they haven't been found. They were probably destroyed as well, but we know so little about them. And so this is the one we know about, and it's the earliest successful Native American uprising. Now, in Zuni and in the Albuquerque area, those pueblos, those people fought as well.
Sure.
And in other places. So there was widespread unrest and battles, but since this was an actual settlement that they were trying to establish, that's why I word it that way.
Now let's bring us to the current day, and another quote out of the documentary where one of the Otham said, they are psyched by the fact that they have this new history. This really means something to them.
It does. It really does. I've been studying their ancestors for 40 years, literally, and one of the things that I have found on other sites and through historical research is that they were considered the best warriors in the 1690s and early 1700s and so on. And today they have a reputation for being docile and peaceful. And I suggest that that's a result of colonialism, in the sense that if you tell people that your heritage is that you were docile and peaceful and that's your custom and the way you should be, then you aspire to be that. But back in the day, they were the best warriors. Even the Apache were scared of them. And this brings it even further back in time, 150 years earlier, basically, and shows that they were so badass, if you want to put it that way, that they had no trouble wiping out that settlement and not getting killed themselves.
Austin Nunez, who's one of the leaders of the Tohono O'odham Nation, points out that Coronado's letters, of course, told a one-sided story, and your work now has given them a voice. What do they do with it now? And I know it's up to them, but what do you think they're going to do with it?
Yeah, well, Chairman Nunez is one of the people who has been very complimentary about this. They all have, because it's shocking and it tells a new story, but they're not surprised. It's shocking that we found evidence for it, but it's something that they know deep down in their souls, I think, because they know they have historical trauma. And they know it went deeply, but we haven't been able to tell this story before. So what we're doing as a group is we're trying to share the film with them, share the history with them through talks. There'll be publications for them. And hopefully they'll, former chairman of the nation itself said, hopefully, you know, they have an obligation to bring this, to teach their young people now this story. And so we're trying to teach the older people and the younger people the importance of the story, the details of the story, and they'll decide themselves the ways that it's important to them.
You brought young Native Americans out to the site. This is documented in the documentary. I was trying to read their eyes, their actions. They're just kind of soaking this in and trying to understand that history had seen them in one way as these victims, but really now you have presented the fact that they were the victors. And in fact, the rebellion kicked the Europeans out for another 150 years. Why did you bring them out to the site?
Well, first of all, there's nothing like being at a place where such a significant history occurred. And I wanted them to be at the place where their ancestors lived and where this significant event happened, and to tell them the story. So we spent all pretty much most of the day there. And I started out by telling them their great, 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 great grandparents were here and so on. And the what I thought was the significance of it. And you could see, usually when I talk to the people at San Javier or WAC, they're the part of the nation that I deal with the most. They're used to listening to my research and my results, and we work together in a lot of ways. And so they were to the point already where they were receptive to this. And it's amazing how much pride this brings to the community as a whole. And like I said in the film, it's a way towards healing. And they're going to be able to take this and make more out of it than I can even imagine. But one of my first papers that's now published is about the impacts of the Coronado Expedition on the O'odham and the O'odham impact on the Coronado Expedition.
Francis, this is, was it a difficult story to tell?
Actually, it was one of the easiest stories, if not the easiest story to tell. I was following in Denny's lead, and it just being there with her, I mean, it just all came together. It was very organic. And I wanted to make a note about the impact on the O'odham. On more than one occasion, we've screened at WAC several times. I've had several people come up to me and say, wow, this is really changing my life, how I see myself. So that was very rewarding. But it was a very easy story to tell. Part of that was Denny, you know, in that she knew where she'd been, where she was now, and where she wanted to go. And I just shadowed her, and we shot probably 200 hours of material, you know, and got it down to 1 hour. So that's really the most challenging part.
And I think what this really has driven home for me, and this is what all of your work does for me, is that it forces you to see things from a different perspective. And now we can see that history is often told from one perspective. And this now forces, the evidence now forces us to look at it from another perspective. Dr. Seymour, you happy with her work?
Very much so. When I first saw it, I was nervous because I don't like being on that side of the camera. That's not why I do this. But I was very pleased. I think she did an incredible job of telling the story. So,
very good. We're going to, one quick question. We only got about a minute left, but the term treasure hunter is used in the documentary. What is it and what kind of damage can they do?
Yeah, well, so basically this is such a huge find that everybody wants a piece of it. We've got so many volunteers that I vet all the time. And, you know, if you metal detect or collect and we don't know where the item was found or the context it was in, we'd lose a lot of information. The reason I was able to reconstruct this battle is because I knew exactly where each of those arrowheads and crossbow bolt heads and pieces of lead came from. That clustering told us that it was a battle. And without that, if somebody just comes and picks it up, then it's just another artifact and we can't really complete the story. So I understand the sentiment for sure, but we're hoping that those people will come on board with us and help us do what we need to do so we can GPS each find and then make a richer story from it.
Very good. Okay, I want to thank Francis Causey and Dr. Denny Seymour for joining us. The time goes way too fast. We could just talk about treasure hunters for 2 hours, I guarantee you that. Once again, Francis, where can people find the film?
On your PBS stations across the country and at PBS Passport.
Okay, and I guarantee you if you Google Coronado, the new evidence, you're going to find it. We're going to be right back. Thank you again. Both of you, you're terrific. We're going to be right back with the Weekend Watch to help you plan your next couple of days. Don't forget, our live line is made possible by the pros over at Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. We'll be back in a minute.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation improvements in the region, averaging more than $100 million in tax revenue each year. The RTA is preparing a new 20-year plan for public review prior to a May 2025 election. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Quality of Life Research Center has conducted more than 100 clinical trials in Arizona over its 20-year history. Because of their success, participants may have access to a variety of treatments under study that may not be available to people outside the trial. And participants may receive compensation for study-related time and travel. If you think you'd like to participate in a clinical trial, please visit QLMC.com to view our open trials and express interest.
It is time for Weekend Watch. It's a great way to plan your next couple of days. Hey, in this case, 3 days. We got a long weekend. It is presented by our friends over in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. They're just 3 hours east of Tucson and a lot cooler. There's so much to do in Silver City and Grant County, including hiking the Gila National Wilderness and visiting the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument. Find out more about what to do and where to stay at southwestnewmexico.org. We now welcome on the line Dan Gibson. We're heading into a three-day Labor Day weekend. Dan, what do you got for us?
Well, I heard you say such nice things about your previous guest that I expect that same level. We go pretty far back, Dan. Come on.
I know. Let's move on.
All right. Well, let's start with Hotel Congress had traditionally had the HOCO Fest event over Labor Day weekend. They have shuffled that deck a little bit, but they have a pretty full calendar, including Arthur Vint, who's a local jazz musician and the front person of their actually runs the whole Century Room project over there. He has a show tonight, Copper State album release. There is a record exchange tomorrow, record fair at Congress starting at 10 a.m. They have the Rock Lottery, which is a bunch of local musicians. They shuffle their names in a bag and they start bands. You can find all this at hotelcongress.com, but if you have any need for something to do, there's plenty on that schedule there at Hotel Congress.
Hey, what's a record exchange? Are you talking like we used to have?
Yeah, like vinyl? Yeah.
Really?
Totally. They fill the whole, club and hotel lobby with record sales people.
I think I still have a Karen Carpenter single. I'm bringing it. Okay.
Oh, you should. You'll probably get good money for it.
Probably.
She was voted Downbeat's best drummer in 1977.
Oh, man. She was awesome. Okay, what else we got?
All right. It's also Comic-Con weekend. It's their 15th anniversary. That actually starts today and runs through Sunday. That's all happening at the TCC. They open up at 2 p.m. today. They have a replica of the Ghostbusters car.
Nice.
And other things, too. I mean, yes. There's plenty happening. Lots of illustrators, drawers, people you know from comic book stuff, plus food trucks and all kinds of things. A really great event. They do a great job there. It's kind of started from nothing and become a pretty big event for Tucson.
Excellent. 15 years running, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's remarkable for anything.
That's
really
terrific. Yeah. What else we got?
All right. Z Street International Market, which is an offshoot of the Zamam's Ethiopian restaurant on Broadway, 2731 East Broadway. They are having a Making Black History Market this Saturday, August 31st, from 7 to 11 p.m. 15 local black-owned businesses, artists, and creatives. You can enjoy food from Zamam's and Zarai's. Something called Trap Yoga from 7:15 to 8:15, which I assume is some mix of the Eastern meditative practice and the 90s and 2000s Atlanta-based rap format, but I can't say for certain.
Go and find out, folks. Sounds interesting.
Yeah, you got to check it out. Report back. But also an after party with DJ Herm from 10 to 11 p.m. should be a good time all around.
Great, Dan Gibson. You know how long it took me to figure out that a spin class is like bicycles? I was just like, what are they doing in there? And then I went and watched one. But okay, very good, Dan. I really appreciate it. And you have yourself a great Labor Day weekend.
Thanks, you too. You're great. You're doing a great job with this show.
Thanks. Again, if you want to listen to the interview we just completed with Francis Causey and Dr. Denny Seymour, it's going to be up on the Buckmaster Show website this afternoon. So hope you enjoyed that. It was fascinating. We could have lasted another couple of hours with him. Just a reminder that the Buckmaster Show radio program is a presentation of Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, which is responsible for the content of the program. Our thanks to Buckmaster Assistant Rosemary Brandt, Producer Engineer John Couch, and Tom Fairbanks. Tom was with me today. And the entire team here at Bustos Media Tucson, you have yourself a great 3-day Labor Day weekend.